Money Movers provides investors with real-time analysis of the stories and the people attracting the attention of markets each day. I'm Carl Quintanilla.
And I'm Sarah Eisen. We'll cover the breaking news and numbers driving stocks and sectors, helping you make critical decisions. Plus, we'll speak with the CEOs, newsmakers, and political leaders playing a role in how your money is moving.
Listen to CNBC's Money Movers free on the Odyssey app.
Wednesday morning, October 16th, just delightful, windy, 56 degrees outside, going up to only 68 today, 69 degrees, not going to bust 70, and that's by 4 o'clock this afternoon. Then overnight lows in the area of 52 or so, and then highs tomorrow, even cooler than it was today. Nice weather Friday, Saturday, Sunday, not even getting out of the 70s, so enjoy that. Then we're back in the lower 80s by the middle of next week. And the presidential race is looming, and as I say, we're going to talk about it being a dead heat. Somebody texted and said, how many people believe that Donald Trump could be leading by as much as 5%, but the mainstream media will report a dead heat? Collusion? No, couldn't happen. Too much honesty and integrity in politics for that ever to occur. Yeah, right. I don't know what the hell this message is supposed to mean, because, first of all, how many people believe? I can believe that, you know, I'm the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, but that doesn't make it true. Secondly, mainstream media, dead heat, I don't know where that has to do with integrity in politics. I don't quite understand what that text is supposed to mean. But David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, it doesn't have to mean anything, does it?
It doesn't have to mean anything. It could just be people emoting, just sort of expressing their views. And God bless America, people have a right to express
God
their views.
God bless America is right. But one thing that surprises me, just looking at it as a voter that doesn't really have a horse in the race, because I'm not crazy about either one of these people, but President yesterday, talking to Maria Bartiromareo, however you say her name, saying that when asked about problems on Election Day, I think the bigger problem is the enemy from within, not even the people that have come in and destroying our country, by the way, totally destroying our country, the towns, the villages, they're being inundated, but that the enemy from within and that the National Guard might have to be called in. I think it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, the National Guard, or really necessary by the military, because they can't let that happen, protecting the election from so-called radical left lunatics. And the only reason I bring all that up is that, you know, if you love Donald Trump, love him. If you hate him, hate him. If you love Kamala Harris, love her. If you hate her, hate her. But from the political analysis standpoint of this, it would seem that Trump has gone, and let me digress for even a moment more, David, if I may. There was a story in The Atlantic where Lindsey Graham was quoted as telling Donald Trump, you already have the people that think the earth are flat and that we didn't land on the moon. You need to move more to the center to try to get them. But it seems as though that Trump has done nothing but double down on the so-called crazy talk, and then that seems to have helped him in the polls. Am I missing something here, or am I misstating that in any way?
No, I think you got it right at this point. I think what's really happened now, especially in the last few weeks and what's going to happen in the last 3 weeks, I don't think either of the candidates really think they can persuade anybody, especially I'm going to say Donald Trump, persuade him to, you know, to change their mind and vote for them. And instead, what I think the focus now for Trump has been on is to say, I've got the people who are with me. I just got to make sure I get them out to vote. And so it's just really getting them riled up even more and more at this point to motivate them to show up to vote. So that's what I think what he's doing versus Harris. Harris still has a little opportunity to be able to maybe persuade a few people who are saying, I don't know really who she is, although I find that hard to believe, and say, I don't know who anything about her, not sure if I'm going to vote or if I'm going to vote for her or something. You know, so she's got a little bit more feeling, if I can use the word here. But I think Trump is like, all right, I can't expand my base. I just need to get as many people in my base to show up to vote. And they seem to be resonating with all these statements. Well, what the heck? I'll keep using them.
But going back to that, it would seem as though if Trump is doubling down on his stuff to get his act, let's just call it that because they both have acts, to get people to turn out and vote. Well, it would seem like that could also motivate people that hate him to turn out and vote against him. No.
I think you're absolutely correct at this point. I'm also at a point now, and I've got relatives, by the way, in Pennsylvania. You know, so I called them up and said, you know, so what's it like there? You know, and they said it's constant advertising. You know, one of them said to me, I can't wait to watch a car ad on television again. If you sort of get the drift, what we're going at here. But they're at the point where they're saying it's like, you know, I've heard enough commercials. I don't want to hear anymore. I think we're at the point now where both of the candidates, and there's evidence of this, have so oversaturated the message. It's not even about messaging now. These last 3 weeks, it's just get your people out and vote at this point. And I think that's really where the campaign needs to be shifting in these last 3 weeks, is that the themes have been defined. For the most part, people know who Trump is. For the most part, people know who Harris is. People have made up their minds. And I don't know if you have to do, for either of them, any more selling. You just have to get them out at this point.
I don't know if... you know, I make stuff up here in my head sometimes, and it's just my gut feeling. I have absolutely no evidence to back this up at all. This is just my gut feeling. My gut feeling tells me that the polls are going to be way off, that people are gaming the polls, and that one way or the other, the election is not going to be as close as those are predicting because the choice is so clear between the two. Do you think I'm wrong there?
I think the polls are missing something, and I can't quite figure this out yet.
Maybe that's what I'm trying to say more, David. They're missing something. Something's not surfacing or something.
Yeah. And again, I'm somebody who's taught polling, taught research, survey research, and so I'm trying to speak as much like a political scientist, is that what you're trying to figure out now is who's likely to vote, a show up to vote. And there's at least a couple of people who are profiles of people we can't really figure out. One is young people. Young people are really hard to get out to vote and for pollsters to reach them. I mean, I talked about this yesterday to a group, and I said, you know, young people are hard to reach, and everybody who's a parent said, yeah, I text my kid and I can't get a hold of them. I know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if young people are accurately capped in the polls. And by the way, not all young people are supporting Harris. There's a lot of young people who supporting Trump. So they're not being caught really well. And some of the older people who are the Trump people, you know, who are, you know, not sure if they're going to vote or something like that, they may not be appearing. And so I think there's a segment or a couple of segments of the population that I don't think are appearing in the polls right now. And I don't know whether it's going to move it more towards Harris or move it more towards Trump. So I truly don't know one way or the other on this one. And again, I go out and speak to like Rotary groups, you know, community groups like you have, you know, back in your town, something like that. And they all say, who's going to win? And I tell them about the polls and I say, they're going to be off, but I don't know how they're going to be off.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to our friend David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University. One thing I don't get is that there are those that are saying that Kamala Harris has a problem, and Barack Obama even addressed this with, I guess, kind of like surfacing objection about black male voters with Kamala Harris. I thought traditionally votes fell along racial lines, but I find it hard to believe that a black man would support Donald Trump, but maybe that's the case. I don't know statistically why. I don't know why that would happen, but that's what they're saying. We'll drill down on that when we come back and what specific groups are going to swing this election. David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, 620 Traffic Now, WWL. Talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, story in the New York Times about the presidential race and black support for Kamala Harris. And there's a quote from a person who owns a tree removal service, black, saying that they would vote for Mr. Trump regardless of how people call him racist and stuff. He is for the country of America. And it would seem to me, if I'm black, the racist would be the top part of that and not the for America. What do the numbers show about traditionally? And again, somebody texted and said I'm racist. I'm not racist at all. I'm just talking about the facts that traditionally it's Democrats attract black voters, correct?
Correct. At least, let's say, since the post-New Deal, since the 1960s, at least. You know, go back 150 years ago, it would have been a different story entirely. You know, but modern history, about 90, 95% of African Americans are going to vote for the Democrat. And we have some evidence, you know, that not as many high percentage of African Americans are going to vote, for Democrats in the way they did. And this has been, 25, 30 years ago. And some are moving toward the Republicans. Now, some of it is about the fact that in some cases, class prevails. And what I mean by that is that, middle class African Americans, business owners, in some cases, are moving and saying, well, gosh, I kind of like the message that the Republicans have about maybe cutting taxes on a small business owner, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of, let us say, wholesale defection, the way that I saw that New York Times piece also, probably not accurate in terms of what we're learning in terms of real polling data. Again, assuming early polling data is accurate.
Well, let me phrase it a different way. What is it about Donald Trump that would appeal to a black male voter?
I'm not sure how much it would be.
Because I didn't see many black men on January 6th at the Capitol.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure if Donald Trump appeals to them, but are black male voters uncomfortable with the idea that a black female might become president of the United States? And that may be the bigger issue. And again, I would want to have more data. I don't want to make a broad-based assertion here, but how much of it now is cutting in terms of the fact that, in the same way that some males are saying, regardless of race, I'm never going to vote for a woman. How much of that is also people who are African American, who are male saying, I'm never going to vote for a woman. And I suspect that's probably true. But again, I don't have hard data, in terms of being able, to back that up.
I know what I saw on January 6th. I can go back and show the text that I was sharing with people on January 6th as it unfolded. Some have gone back and rewritten the history of January 6th for their own convenient purposes. Does that factor into this election at all?
The rewriting of the history?
Well, January 6th thing, the whole thing.
Okay. Yes, it does factor in. For some people, it is stolen election. For some people, it is the assault on democracy, depending on what your perspective is. And so is it the top issue compared to the economy or immigration or abortion? No. But for some people, this is an issue that's moving them, and it's tapping into their emotions regarding whether they support Trump or oppose Trump.
Somebody texted me a couple of weeks ago and said, I remember what happened on January 6th, and there's no way I'll give him control of the military again, because whoever controls the military controls the country, which seems like a logical, rational thought, but that's got nothing to do with this election. All right, 6:45, quarter till 7, beautiful Wednesday morning, not trying to bring anybody down or anything, cool weather's here, enjoy it, but a fact of life is people are going to die today. They died yesterday. People are going to die tomorrow. And for families that are dealing with that, sometimes it can be an overwhelming challenge. So whether you want to talk about it or not, you do need to kind of address this. And Liz Dunaback knows that. She's the executive director of WAKE, and she's going to help us talk about that now. Good morning, Liz. How are you?
Good morning. Fine, thank you.
Having gone through this with my parents, when I saw this story by Rich Collins at NOLA.com, it really resonated because it can be challenging, it can be emotional, it can be, in some cases, angering because people buy pre-need policies and then when they go to cash them in, they find out it's not what they thought it was going to be. And sometimes people are stretched for cash and they want to do what's right by their loved ones. Tell me about your organization.
Exactly. That's why we founded it, because everybody struggles at this time when they lose loved ones. And so there's very few places to turn. And I founded WAKE basically because of those same reasons, because I was really struggling in the wake of losing loved ones. And I just figured there had to be some place to turn to ask basic questions about what to do, how to proceed.
So how does your organization help? Tell me about it.
Well, people often call us or email us in the wake of losing somebody and just sort of ask what to do next, and we can help them navigate that time. We encourage people to price shop for funeral services, and we help them with that by collecting price lists from area funeral homes, helping people sort of navigate, the different options and figure out how they can get what they want, maybe most affordably, if that's a factor for them. we help just advise people on what issues are that they're going to be confronting. There's so many that happen all at once. You have to, you know, there's a person that has to be buried or cremated, and then there's also memorialization. Sometimes you have to wind down an estate if you're the executor. There's a lot of things, so we can help refer people to services like legal services or bereavement services if that's what they need. We just kind of help each family with whatever needs they're dealing with.
I know they've kind of morphed it into death care, the funeral industry, and I got nothing against the funeral industry, but the bottom line is the person has already deceased. They're not providing care to anybody, perhaps the family. They are providing a service, but along those lines, it is a retail business, is it not?
It is, although I like to say death care is health care. I mean, you know, until what we call disposition happens, you know, that final act of burying somebody or cremating them, there's still a patient, and by law, we have to take care of that patient, and that pretty much falls to families as soon as death occurs. So if you think about it, you know, you're caring for your loved one all through the end of life, but you are supported by perhaps a hospital or maybe hospice. There are healthcare services that are available to you, but as soon as death occurs, you have no more options available to you other than a private funeral industry, and yet you still have to take care of that body. And so I do think that there needs to be more resources at that juncture for people, because families are required to deal with their person, and yet they don't have any support for it.
Yeah, what are the common, you know, I hate to say this, but if somebody gets a notice today that's a loved one, who does it fall to? To take care of the disposition, you said, or whatever it is? Is it the next of kin? Is that whose responsibility it falls on? And you want there to be dignity in this, but yet, you know, people don't have $10,000, $12,000, $14,000 to throw around for a funeral, right?
Exactly. And that's exactly right. It does fall to the next of kin, which is also confusing because you might in life name a healthcare power of attorney. You know, if you go in for a procedure in the hospital, they'll help you complete that paperwork. But that's a power of attorney, and that actually expires at death, and many people don't realize this. So then they go to the funeral home to make arrangements for their loved one, only to find out that they're not technically the legal next of kin, and so they can't make arrangements, but somebody must, and it falls to, you know, an order of next of kin to deal with that. And then, yes, they are compelled to hire private funeral services because by law, the deceased has to be in the care of a licensed funeral director. This is in Louisiana only, and some other states, but not all states are this way. But in Louisiana, the deceased has to be in the care of a licensed funeral director all the way until disposition, and that costs thousands of dollars.
So you could be estranged from your next of kin for whatever reason. They could expire, and then all of a sudden you get a call saying, okay, this is blank and blank, whatever, funeral home, we have your loved one, and then what do you want us to do with it, basically, or not? Is that the way it works?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I think that's a big surprise for a lot of people. We can actually fix that with a very simple form that can be done sort of as part of your advanced care planning paperwork.
Well, let me talk about that when we come back, all right?
Yeah. Sure.
We'll talk about it when we come back, about advanced planning when we return. Liz Dunaback, Executive Director of WAKE. Nobody likes to talk about it, but it's a fact of life, if you will. It is going to happen. We're all going to, at one point, go. And along those lines, you don't want to leave. I don't think you want to leave anybody with a burden or your kids or anything else. You don't leave them with a $12,000, $14,000, $15,000 bill where they go get the money from. Or if you worked hard to leave them a couple of bucks, you don't want them to eat it up, I don't think. With that, 651 9 till 7. You got any questions? 504-260-1870. That's the O'Connor Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Time now for WWL Traffic. All right, 656 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL. You might be estranged from your next of kin or whatever. It might be somebody's next of kin and not know it. And all of a sudden you get a call from a funeral home saying, hey, we got blank here, and what do you want us to do? And you could be on the hook for thousands of dollars. I hate to say it that way, but when it comes to disposition, you want there to be dignity, but you don't want to be taken advantage of. You also don't want to get stuck with something that you didn't necessarily plan on. Liz Dunaback is executive director of Wake. It's a nonprofit that tries to help people navigate the funeral services industry. So, Liz, what would you advise people to do both, I guess, beforehand and advance planning and to make sure that they don't, I hate to use the phrase burden because it's cliche, but they don't present a challenge to people after they go?
Exactly. I think advanced care planning is probably the single most important step that anybody can take, in life to sort of ensure that there's peace of mind at the end of it. And it's pretty straightforward. I mean, it's just a few documents. You can get them prepared and notarized by a notary public. You don't have to use a lawyer for that. But we do also recommend that people consider, making a will and consulting with an estate lawyer to just make sure that their ducks are in a row. It's not free, but it can be affordable. And certainly we refer people a lot of times to affordable services. We can also do advanced care planning for people for free. We have a notary public on staff, and we do that for people all the time. And then I think just sort of thinking about what you want to do and talking about it with your family is also really key. People don't like to talk about death. I think there's a unspoken superstition. We sort of think that, like, if we talk about it, it will make it happen. And we like to say that talking about death doesn't make you die, just like talking about sex doesn't make you pregnant. Mm-hmm. Sort of the same concept.
Nobody can lead to it. I'm just kidding. It's just a joke.
So, yeah, if you can start having those conversations, help your loved ones know what things are important to you, what you'd like to have done with you after you go, that can be a real gift to the family because, as you say, we're all going to die, and your loved ones are going to have to deal with this eventually.
I've had the conversation with my 28-year-old kid, and I said, look, I'm working my beans off to leave whatever I can to you. The last thing I would want is for you to waste money on a funeral service for me because I believe it's just the body, the spirit is gone. With that being said, do what you feel comfortable with. How can people find out more about your organization, Liz?
Well, our website has most of our information handy, and that's at www.wake.education. You can also call us anytime at 504-689-6330, and we'll work with everybody just to sort of see what their needs are and see how we might be able to point them in the right direction.
Thanks for coming on. Let me tell you, thanks for what you're doing because I think it's very important. I really do. We'll take a break, come back, talk about early childhood education.
This is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune. I'm CNBC senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.
It is delightful outside. If you have not been outside, man, you could be pleasantly surprised. 55 degrees and windy. It's that first cool day of the year that we all wait for, and finally it's here. Tomorrow, highs of 79. Kind of cool tonight. Lows around 59, 60 degrees. Then tomorrow, I got ahead of myself here, 69 for a high today, 73 tomorrow. Tim, it's going to be cool and nice. Let's just leave it at that. Libby Saunier joins us now, Executive Director of Louisiana Policy Institute for Children. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you.
If I'd had better early childhood education, perhaps I wouldn't have butchered the weather like I just did. What do you think?
Perhaps.
Yeah. Tell me about the importance of early childhood education before we talk about budget cuts, if you would, please.
Sure. So what we know fundamentally is that 90% of brain development happens before the age of five. And so these early years are critically important. What we also know is that creating access to quality early care and education really does help parents be able to stay in the workforce and or go to school.
How has this changed, Libby, in the state of Louisiana through the years, just maybe going back a decade or two? And I ask that because I think there are proven results, are there not?
Absolutely. So what we've seen over the last, decade really is that when we have increased investments in early care and education, our children tend to do better in school, particularly if we look at the longitudinal work by the Council for a Better Louisiana with our LA4, which is our four-year-old program in the state. So for young children that have access to quality early care and education the first 5 years of life. They're more prone to finish high school, read on grade level, participate in the workforce, and have better life outcomes as they age.
So I should say, Dr. Libby Sonnier, if everything's working so well, why would we fool with it?
I mean, I don't think we should fool with it. I think that we need increased investment in access to quality early care and education, particularly if you look at our labor participation rate. We know that a major barrier for families is finding affordable, quality early care and education so that they can be in the workforce. And so, you know, we're hopeful that we can continue to make the case for why quality early care and education is important, not just for school readiness, but also for parents to be able to stay in the workforce.
Maybe I phrased that question kind of awkwardly. I guess what I meant to ask is, what is at risk now with the so-called fiscal cliff, budget, maybe tax reform, sales tax dropping off? How concerned are you that something will change?
I think we're fairly concerned that we could see a reduction in the child care assistance program in our state with state dollars. And that would be concerning because that would mean that families wouldn't have access to quality early care and education and they wouldn't be able to go to work. And that's a problem. And we want to make sure that, you know, we can keep families working in Louisiana and make sure that our young children enter into kindergarten ready to learn. Because currently right now, 70% of kindergartners are entering in kindergarten in Louisiana that are they're already behind. And once children start behind, they tend to stay behind. So we want to make sure we're keeping these little people in quality early care and education, and we're keeping families working.
Let me drill down a little bit on the importance of reading at level, I guess, when you get to the third grade. We have a big problem in Louisiana with that, do we not?
We do. I mean, I will say that Superintendent Brumley at the Louisiana Department of Education has really galvanized about the science of reading and making sure that children are able to read on grade level. And part of that process is making sure and ensuring that children have access during those first 5 years of life to quality early care and education.
And as you said earlier, I know you are an educator, that once a child gets in that hole, it's hard to pull out of that, isn't it?
It is. It's once you start behind, you stay behind. And, you know, the schools are not meant to catch children up by two or three grade levels. And so we want to make sure that we're starting young children on the right trajectory. We only have one right way to get it right the first time. And so ensuring that children are entering into kindergarten ready to learn so that they can read on grade level by third grade, do well in middle school, finish high school, go on to post-secondary, and be in the workforce. And then for those parents that are in the workforce now, that they can stay in the workforce because they have access to quality early care and education.
You know, I have a 28-year-old that's a teacher, and I hear stories about third graders that, you know, have a hard time with just the basics of things that a kindergartner should know. And this third grade, and you got to wonder how they got promoted to that level. So how does that happen? How does a child go, and how does a third grade teacher wind up getting a kid that can't read, barely knows numbers, et cetera?
Well, and I think that's, again, like a real focus of the Department of Education here in Louisiana is focusing on the fundamentals of reading and numeracy. Because at the end of the day, we've got to be in a place that we're not passing kids on, that we're ensuring that our children have the tools that they need to be successful in school and in life. And so that really starts, I would say, prenatally, but particularly in those first 5 years of life, to make sure that we have enough, as many children as we can, have access to quality early care and education. If we look at the rates right now, less than 30% of children that are at risk in our state, birth to three, have access to quality early care and education. We've got to make that number better so that we can make sure that children are entering into kindergarten ready to learn and they're able to read on grade level at third grade.
I want to talk about the economic benefits when we come back. Also, I don't know, you know, you got to hold the teachers accountable, but I don't know what a third grade teacher is supposed to do when they get a kid that's passed on to them that can't read. Because you say once you're behind, you stay behind. It's not the school's job to bring them up. So what happened? And for people, I think, Dr. Sonnier, that are not involved with this or not had somebody that's involved with it, they don't quite understand the extent of the problem. So you got a third grade teacher gets a kid that can't read, is numeral, how do you say it, illiterate, doesn't know their numbers? How would you phrase that?
the numeracy? I think, you know, fundamentally is what schools do is they do catch up children. They focus on intervention to ensure that we're catching these kids up as much as we can. But inevitably, there still are going to be some gaps for children that don't get caught up. And so that's really the focus of making sure that young children have access to quality early care and education in those first 5 years of life, so that when children get into the K-12 system, that those K-12 teachers are able to have the art of teaching and make sure that children are having what they need to be successful in school and in life.
But the fact is, if that third grader can't read, or a couple of third graders can't read, or half the third grade class can't read, or a third, that teacher's going to have to, and the assistants are going to have to devote more time with them, catching them up, which detracts from what
Absolutely.
They can spend to the other kids. So it has an overall effect.
Absolutely, it does. It absolutely does. And I think that, again, you know, the K-12 world is not my bailiwick and where I spend my time, but I really have to give a kudos to our Department of Education on the focus related to literacy and numeracy in the state to ensure that kids that are behind, that we're trying to catch them up the best that we can, and we're doing it based on the science of how young children learn and how they acquire literacy and numeracy skills.
All right, let's talk about the economics of this. We come back. Dr. Libby Sonnier, our guest, Executive Director of Louisiana Policy Institute for Children. I want to talk about like a scale. I don't know if there's a sliding scale or not about what kind of cuts it would have to take to make a big difference, and if there's any synergy involved, the more money you get, the better the results magnified. 722 traffic now, WWL. 727 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Dr. Libby Sonnier, Executive Director of Louisiana Policy Institute for Children, talking about looming, I guess, Doctor, that'd be accurate, looming cuts to early childhood education. Has your organization been brought into this, and are they listening to what you have to say about the importance of getting kids ready from before they get to kindergarten?
I would say they're potential cuts. Nothing is written in stone yet. And so that leaves us in a spot of continuing to make the case for, you know, increased investment or just maintaining investments that we have in the state in quality early care and education. We just did a release last week with the state chamber, with the Louisiana Association for Business and Industry, related to a early childhood commission report being released. And Will Green, you know, from LAHBI, is really clear that for many Louisianians, a lack of access to affordable, high quality early care and education is a significant barrier to entering and remaining in the workforce. And so when we know these types of things from our business leaders, it's really hard to stomach that there could be potentially cuts to early care and education, because we know that our families need them.
And that's what I wanted to drill down on in a minute that we have remaining. Even if you don't have a kid that's before pre-kindergarten education, the availability of that is important to you as a business owner or just as a resident of Louisiana, right?
It absolutely is. It affects all of us. You know, if our labor participation rates don't increase, we're not going to have Louisianians working. And we know that we need them to. And we know that families fundamentally need to work to take care of their families and to be able to care for their children. And so ensuring that families are able to go to work is increasingly important to our workforce development and our economic development. And we're hearing that from chambers across the state and economic developers across the state. I mean, if you want to get somebody rolling on the importance of access to quality early care and education, Michael Heck can give you a heck of a spiel, because he knows that that's how we're going to be able to recruit and retain talent in our state.
Oh, Michael Heck can give you a heck of a spiel on anything. I'm just kidding. Thank you, Dr.
Sonnier.
He is.
He's fantastic.
He is. Thank you. I appreciate
your
time. It just seems like of everything that could potentially be cut, this would be the thing on the bottom of the list, because it gives you the most bang for your buck. Accurate?
Exactly. For every dollar that we spend on quality early care and education, we can get a 13% return on investment. Why wouldn't we invest in our children and in our families?
That's hard to find, a 13% return. Thank you, Dr. Sonnier. We'll talk to you again soon. We'll come back. We'll talk about why politically charged content gets more engagement on social media. Right now, time for WWL First News. We are in for a beautiful stretch of weather. If you're, maybe I should shout, because you might be driving around with the windows roll down. I say we're in for a stretch of beautiful weather. Highs today of 72, lows tonight in the 50s, then 69 for a high tomorrow, 73, 75 Friday and Saturday. Sunday is going to be great. Highs of 77 and really in the 70s through next Monday. And as you go to the Dome tomorrow night for the Saints-Broncos game. Let that cool weather get you fired up and really support them, because now's the time they need you. Not when they're going to the playoffs or when they're in the NFC Championship game. Now's the time they really need the crowd behind them. Daniel Moshon joins us right now, Associate Professor of Marketing at the A.B. Freeman School of Business at Tulane. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Is it Moshon? Did I say that right?
That is right, yes. Okay.
We're going to talk about this study, a new Tulane University study that explains why politically charged content gets more engagement on social media. And let me ask the audience here at 504-260-1870. I know they call it doom scrolling, but do you anger scroll? Does the audience, do you go through things that you find just waiting to get you angry and then you respond to them? Show me what your study showed, Professor.
So in our research, we examined a pattern that we named the confrontation effect. And this effect is the tendency of online users to engage more with content they disagree with than with content they agree with, especially for highly charged topics like political beliefs. And we find that this effect is mainly due to the outrage that people feel in response to belief-challenging content, which motivates them to confront and fight back against it. So in other words, we see things that we disagree with, it makes us angry. That anger makes us want to fight back and essentially attack the source of the anger. And we label this entire pattern the confrontation effect.
So you're more inclined to respond to something that you disagree with than agree?
Yes, for highly charged topics. We don't see this effect for things people don't care that much about, mm-hmm. like if you're debating, you know, what brand of phone you want or something like that. But for really core values, like our political beliefs, our religious beliefs, that kind of stuff, you know, people get really upset when they see something that goes against their beliefs, and that just encourages them to essentially engage and fight back against it.
Yeah, the first thing I thought of is that people, when I saw this, that people are more inclined to either call a manager over if they're not happy, or write a letter, or go on media and post a negative review about something if they're angry, than they are a positive thing. Does that have anything to do with this at all?
Well, I think in general, outrage is a very strongly motivating emotion, and I think we see the effect of outrage in different settings. So in consumer settings, for sure, if we have a very bad experience and a company makes us upset, that motivates us to go and complain to a manager or post online. You know, the source of the outrage is a little bit different, but I think the motivation is quite similar in these settings.
When it comes to facts entering into this, or truth entering into this, which in this day and age is incredibly hard to find, and I don't know that, you know, now we get philosophical, Professor, right, with what is absolute truth, and there are so many nuances and so many complexities involved with what some people perceive to be simple problems. There are no simple solutions to complex problems. Does that matter in this, or is it just all emotion, or was the study able to determine any of this?
So in our study, we didn't see very much on facts. What we saw is a lot of people just getting upset and kind of yelling back. But I think in the broader question of facts online is a really important one, because as you said, there's a lot of misinformation online, and it's important to, you know, help people better process and better engage with information. And I think that's the bigger question we're interested in understanding. How do we get people to engage in a positive, productive way with information online, especially in for topics that are important for our country, but that people struggle to look at what the other side is talking about?
I like the difference here between sports or fashion reflecting interest and political engagement stemming from anger, causing a vicious cycle. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes, so there's a lot of research on showing that things that challenge our core values create a much larger degree of outrage than other topics that, you know, we have beliefs about, but they aren't really core to ourselves. Like, you know, I might prefer Nike over Reebok or Reebok over Nike, but if someone tells me that Nike is not a good sneaker, it's not something that's going to outrage me, because it's just not a core part of who I am. But if someone starts talking about, you know, political parties or, you know, very deeply held beliefs, then that is the kind of stuff that people get upset about and can lead to this type of effect.
The other thing I thought of when I read this is, you know, how many times have you had a discussion with somebody where you said, are you trying to make me mad? And I realized that, yes, that's exactly what they're trying to do, is make you mad. And we'll talk about the reasons for that when we come back with Daniel Moshon, an executive associate professor of marketing at the A.B. Freeman School of Business at Tulane. New Tulane University study explains why politically charged content gets more engagement on social media. And yes, they are trying to get you mad. And we'll talk about why when we come back. 7:50, 10 till 8, Traffic Now, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Dr. Daniel Moshon, associate professor of marketing at the prestigious A.B. Freeman School of Business at Tulane. New study explains why politically charged content gets more engagement on social media. And Professor, I was saying earlier, you know, like when you have an argument with somebody and they say, are you trying to get me mad? That's kind of what they're trying to do. And it leads to a cycle that's based on algorithms, and we're being manipulated. Explain that, if you would, please.
Well, the way most online platforms work is that they look at people's engagement to try to figure out what type of content they want to show them. And in most cases, that's actually a pretty good rule to follow. If I engage with posts about fashion, I probably care about fashion. If I engage with posts about sports, I probably care about sports. The problem comes into the domain of politics, or rather, you know, core beliefs that we have, where the type of content that we engage with isn't necessarily a good reflection of what we want to, you know, see more of. Our research shows that when we see things we disagree with, it makes us angry. That makes us engage with it. And because of the way these algorithms work, it's just going to lead to being fed more of this anger-inducing content. And so it sort of creates this vicious cycle where I'm shown stuff I don't like, I get angry, I engage with it out of anger, and then it shows me more of it, and I get caught in this vicious negative cycle of anger and engagement.
With an eye toward what? Who's generating the content, and what is the ultimate goal here?
Well, I mean, I think there are many parties involved. The platforms themselves, like the social media networks, their goal is just to keep you on the network. You know, the longer, the more time you spend there, the more ads they can show you, and so the more money they can make. And so whatever keeps you engaged, whether it's positive or negative, the more they'll show you of it. You know, as for the parties trying to induce outrage, well, outrage is very motivating. And so if I'm working in politics and I'm trying to get my base riled up, you know, outrage is a good way to do so. And so I think it's being used as a tactic to get people motivated and take action. But at the same time, it's not necessarily great for the users or for society in general to have everyone in a constant state of outrage.
That was my next question, because it's outrage for outrage's sake, and that can't have good effects throughout society, right? In the real world, when you get off of social media and then try, does that, I guess the question, doctor, is does it transfer from social media into people's everyday lives and interactions?
I think so. I mean, over the past few years and decades, we've seen a big rise in political polarization. You know, people are talking less and less to those across the political aisle. And there are many factors behind that, but I would guess that social media and this outrage machine is in part contributing to people not being able to engage anymore in a positive way with those they disagree with or those who have different opinions than theirs.
Hence, are you trying to get me mad? Thank you, doctor. I appreciate your time. Dr. Daniel Moshon, associate professor of marketing at the A.B. Freeman School of Business at Tulane. It can also lead to nut jobs saying they're going out to hunt FEMA workers in North Carolina, which doesn't help anything. And I realize he's an isolated nut job. I get that, but still. We'll talk to Ronald Serpas. We come back, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief. We'll talk about crime and policing in New Orleans. Then we're going to talk about electric vehicles. A lot coming up. Stay with us.
You got to take a listen to this. It's Squawk Pod.
That's right. CNBC's flagship business news show is a podcast, Squawk Pod.
This is CNBC Control 2.
It is not just the show, folks.
It might be even better because it's only audio.
Join me, Katie Kramer, as I take you inside the Squawk Box control room and beyond the headlines of our TV broadcast with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin every weekday.
Roll alpha.
Listen to CNBC's Squawk Pod free on the Odyssey app.
Beautiful, beautiful day outside. I hope you're enjoying it. Maybe got the windows rolled down, letting the wind blow through your hair. That's what I was doing earlier coming in. Highs today only approaching 70 degrees, and that's going to be the same way for tomorrow. Chilly start, too, with lows in the 50s. Highs on Friday, 73, nothing but sunshine. Another start in the 50s. Likewise for Saturday, a little bit warmer through the weekend, 75 and 77 for Saturday and Sunday. But, man, finally, first stretch of autumn weather, and you got to get out and enjoy that. Ronald Serpas joins us now, director of, well, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, former head of the Washington State Police, Nashville City Police, consultant to numerous departments, and an all-around nice guy. How you doing, Chief?
I'm pretty good, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Let's talk about, before we get to crime in the city, I want to ask you this about the story I saw from Missy Wilkinson back in October 6th from NOLA.com about the graduation rate of the police academy. Class 201, 7 officers out of 25. Class 200, 10 out of 23. Class 199, started with 33, ended with 19. How does that fit in with the national statistics or when you were superintendent at different departments? Is that normal for people to drop out the academy at that rate?
Well, it's not particularly normal over history. We used to suffer around a 5% dropout after accepted to the academy. Mm-hmm. But there are things that are changing. A lot of people are being pressured to consider policing that might not have thought about it long enough. And then once they got in the academy, maybe realized that's not what they wanted. The Police Chiefs Association, which you know I'm a member, we're going to be there all next week working. We just did a survey of our membership answered by 1,200 departments in the country, and we're finding it's very common that officers leave within the first 3 years of hire, which is a difference. So that might have some impact on officers that are coming into academies and maybe realizing that's not what they wanted. The worst view would be is they're hiring anybody who shows up, which I really hope and don't believe that's the case. But we do come to believe, after all this research we've done with our departments in the country, 18,000 that we represent, smarter recruiting leads to better retention. So we need to be very clear in the recruitment practices now. Having been a former SWAT commander, having been a former mounted officer, a former motorcycle officer, we need to show less of that and show more of changing people's tires, comforting a child at a scene, helping someone find their way who's hurt, damaged, or hurt, or lost, or injured. Because policing is not what we see on television every day with this climbing through windows and crashing through doors. It's much more about guardianship and helping, and that's one of the things we're going to be pushing in the next year, producing a video for police departments around the country that we think has been well-researched by a lot of people to say, let's really show people what policing is more coherently. And then when they make their choice, maybe it's closer to what their expectations will be.
You know, I asked Newell about this, and he talked about when he was sheriff, the structuring of the academy, and they did some exit surveys and found that sometimes people didn't like firing a gun, or when they got to the range, that was one of the things that led them to drop out. So they kind of changed it around and reshuffled it, and I believe I'm quoting it properly here, and put it kind of like toward the beginning of the training where, well, if you don't really like this, then maybe this is not for you. Does the progression of the training have anything to do with this?
Yeah, a lot of us did the same things. It used to be the case that we would lose a lot of candidates when they would take their final law exams, meaning not lawyer, but their final law exams. We'd lose a lot of people. And we'd lose a lot of people at the firearm range. And then we hired some former, believe it or not, we hired some former Marine Corps drill instructors who were firearm specialists. And they said to us, if you're losing people at the firearms range, it's likely that you're not training them well, because look how many millions of people we bring into the Marine Corps over the last generations. We taught them all how to shoot. So, yes, you have to think aggressively about the timing of some of these issues, the pressures that are built in by it, a one or done, right? You go through a 26-week academy. They save the firearms training until the 20th week. There's a tremendous amount of pressure on people that have never shot a gun before. Mm-hmm. I agree with Newell. We used to do it, too. Get all those things done up front to make sure that it is consistent with what people's expectations are. Use professional trainers. Don't assume that anybody can just pick up a 9mm or a 40 caliber and be efficient. And then particularly the harder classes, the law classes, the investigation classes, I agree. You put those a little closer to the front. And then here's the other problem, Tommy, and this is one I take most seriously as a GED graduate myself. Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of time teaching people fundamental writing skills because of the failure of many of the high schools in the country, particularly public schools. So you got to imagine that. I mean, you bring in 20 recruits, and if many of them are struggling with basic English structure of sentencing, it's really a lot of work to bring them up to speed, because a police officer's work is driven mostly by how they write and what they write.
You know, you talked about, well, first of all, the Marines, as I understand it, I don't care if you're, as I understand it, if you, whether you're a cook or a stenographer or whatever, you're a rifle person, a rifleman when you leave the Marines, right? One way or the other, you got to be a you got to learn how to use that rifle.
That's exactly right. I spoke with Colonel Terry Everett about that just a few weeks ago because someone was saying that someone who'd been in the Marine wasn't a soldier. And I said, Terry, please remind me, every Marine is a soldier first. He said, absolutely. Whether you're the commandant or a cook, you're a soldier first. You know how to use a weapon and you can be expected to be in war at any moment. So, yes, that's exactly right.
So, secondly, when it comes to recruiting, and I know that there's some very active, you know, efforts to recruit police officers. Does that go to whether it's a job or a calling?
I think you bring up a good point. I hope that people see policing as a calling. I think it's a noble profession. But here's the issue, Tommy. I've been, myself and many others have been advocating, look, we appreciate, everyone appreciates when cities come together with funding to give recruitment bonuses. The real issue is retention. Tommy, if I recruit you as a police officer and give you $10,000 bonus, that's a good thing. But, you know, you don't become a real member of the service in full capacity till you're 3, 4, 5 years into the work. Mm-hmm. Well, that's when we're losing most of the people, when they're 3, 4, 5 years into the work. And when you lose all them by not recruiting smartly, you end up having a double hole. You're bringing in people who are not making it through the academy for whatever reason because you're trying to push more numbers in. And then when you get to that 3 to 5 year mark, our research is so crystal clear with the police chiefs across the country is we're losing them then too. That speaks to retention. How do we retain people after we get them in?
Is that because of what they experience on the job where they realize this is not what I thought it was going to be? Do they do exit interviews on this?
A lot of times it's going to turn out to be, I didn't really know this was the case, but this is a funny story. It's a true story. One of our district commanders got some new recruits when I was chief and said to me, I can't believe Mardi Gras came and they quit. And I asked them, and they said, why'd y'all quit? And they said, well, we didn't know we had to work during Mardi Gras. I thought we could be off and enjoy the parades. Mm. So sometimes that's a little bit of a parody. But what you have is that people don't really expect until you actually do the work. And we're going to lose some by not recruiting smartly, showing the real truth was what we hope to do, and then find a way to retain. You know, there's a huge bill in front of the Congress to it's a very complex process, but essentially police officers' widows lose substantial, if not all, of the Social Security benefit from their husbands. If you're from one of the seven states like Louisiana, where that's not counted as your contribution to Medicare, even though you paid, Medicaid, Social Security, even though you paid. Mm-hmm. So there's a retention piece, Tommy. We've got to focus a lot on retention.
You know, we go through it a little bit here in a much lesser degree, but it's, what do you mean I can't take vacation? Well, there's a hurricane in the Gulf.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, well, I want to evacuate. Well, no, that's why you have the job. That's what we do here. You understand? 8:22, we'll take a break. Pick it up. We come back. Ronald Surpass, our guest. I'm Tommy Tucker. A look at traffic now on WWL. 8:27, Tommy Tucker, WWL, having our weekly conversation with our friend Ronald Surpass, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, head of the Nashville City Police, Washington State Police Chief. Are you going to a Taylor Swift concert or not?
No. I'll be with the Police Chiefs Association for the next week, tomorrow.
Because I was going to say, if you are, you should let people know where you're sitting so they don't sit behind you because they're not going to be able to see anything as tall as you are.
I have the image of your wind blowing in the hair.
Yeah.
Your hair blowing in the wind. I'm still trying to get my head wrapped around that.
Yeah, I had the windows open, the hair just, it's kind of like something from Baywatch you would see. Let me ask you about this long term, because, you know, you can't think, like you're talking about the police chiefs, is that here chief in town or not?
No, the Police Chiefs Association, we have, good Lord, we have 40,000 members. We have our annual conference this year. We'll have about 20,000 delegates. And we'll I'm sorry, it's in Boston this year.
So
it's been in New Orleans before, but it's in Boston this year.
So let me ask you this. You can't think a year down the line. You can't think 5 years down the line when it comes to something like this. You got to think 10 years down the line. And I can think of nothing worse than having an officer that you train and you put 3 years into, 5 years into, just when they're about ready to really be competent on the street, then you lose them. So what does the future look like? What does it portend 3 to 5 years from now, even 10 years out?
You know, we're still trying to figure that out. We have some really super smart people at Michigan State University, Professor Jeremy Wilson. They spend all their time focusing on this. And I think when you consider retention, we have to think about it from the place that you and I are not familiar. If you go to parts of the country that have very strong collective bargaining agreements, the winning factor is you breathed one day longer than me. You get benefits I don't get because you breathe longer. That's a significant issue. Another issue is how do we continue to keep pay increases in those mid-ranges, right? We put a lot of money at the front with recruitment bonuses, not against it. But what are we doing in the mid-ranges when we really want to continue to get these folks here? The third thing is, and it's a really difficult one, Tommy, a lot of officers are never going to get promoted to sergeant, lieutenant, or captain because it's just a smaller, it's a pyramid, right? So how do we keep having variety of officer duties in that 5-10 year period of experience that helps them explore new avenues of engagement? But if you're not recruiting, then you end up having gaps where people have to stay in patrol. And then third, Tommy, it really raises this question. In 2014, we had an external expert study our staffing. In 2012, we used the greatest computer programs off the shelf to study our staffing, and we thought we needed 1,600 people. Sometime after I left, they said they thought it was 1,200 people. Now we're living with around 900 people, and we're having some significant crime declines. Maybe the next administration will take the time to do a very workload-based authentication study of what does the police department really need to be in today's times, not what we thought in 12 and 14 or 17 or 18. What do we think in 24, 25, 26? Now, here's why I say that. What if it turns out we have these dramatic crime declines, which we were all happy about, and we did it with 900 people, but we're telling the cops every day that you should be sad because you don't have 1,200 because you should have 12. What if 1,200 is not the right number? Mm-hmm. What if it's a different number? And that's how you got to plan for 5 years out and et cetera, because if police department in New Orleans needs 1,200 people after an authenticating external validated study, then we shoot for it. But what if it says a different number that we don't know because we haven't thought about it in that term? That affects recruitment and retention greatly.
The other thing I wanted to talk to you about real quick, and we only have a minute left, is you talked about the difference in approaches between not riding motorcycles or horses or this or that, the other thing, but I guess comforting kids, and I don't mean to misquote you here, but talk about that real quick if you can.
Policing is a lot about just helping people when they call you. You don't get to pick what they call you for. So we respond to everything as usually the government's most visible arm. And that's where you meet people where they live. You find people who are sad because their child isn't home yet. Can you help them? You find people who are sad because they can't find their way through the city because they're lost from another town. You help them. That's really the essence of policing, is guarding and helping people.
Thank you, Chief. Appreciate your time as always. Ronald Surpass, Professor of Practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD Chief. We'll talk with Wesley Mueller when we come back about EVs and Louisiana adapting. Minute late, time for WWL First News. At 8:45, quarter till 9, beautiful morning to ride around with the windows open. And I guess if you're in an EV, I don't know if you hear anything but the wind. Wesley Mueller joins us now, staff writer at Louisiana Illuminator, talk about Louisiana lagging behind the rest of the country when it comes to adopting electric vehicles. How you doing, Wesley?
Hey, how you doing?
Happy to be here. Thanks for taking the time with us. I want to ask the audience here, first of all, to chime in on the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talking text line at 504-260-1870. If you have an EV, do you use it for long-distance traveling, or do you have any trouble finding charging stations? I remember a long time ago, seemingly a long time ago, relatively speaking, I had a kid who lives in North Louisiana in Natchitoches, and there's an Exxon station there off of the highway leading to Manny that had a big four-post charging station. I don't know what the hell it was at first, but then I figured it out. Tell me, before we get to charging stations and infrastructure, what is the trend with EV sales, hybrids, et cetera? How do they track these things, Wesley?
They're becoming very, very popular. They have sold, just so far this year, 730,000 electric and hybrids. And, it's on track to top over one and a half million this year. The highest sales volume ever recorded. And currently, that's one out of every five cars in the United States is electric or hybrid now. And that, compare that to just, say, 2016, when it was 3%, that's a sevenfold increase. As the more EVs are on the road, we're seeing fewer and fewer gas and diesel vehicles. And it's mainly just because of consumer choice and the cost. The cost has come down tremendously. The technology has allowed the battery capacity to increase the range of electric vehicles to where they're now on par with gas vehicles, you know, the amount that you can get from a full tank of gas. So, you know, your question earlier about can we use these things for long range travel? Mm-hmm. Yes, you can. If you purchase one of them that has that range capacity, the base models,
go ahead.
The base models that are really cheap, you know, you can get them for $32,000. And the federal government offers a $7,500 tax credit that's taken off the price at the dealership. Those will go about 200 miles on a single charge. So a little bit less. Those I wouldn't bank on for long distance travel.
What did you say about one in five? What?
One out of every five cars today is electric or hybrid.
So with that being said, not one out of every, if you want to call them recharging or refueling stations or repowering stations, might be a better way to lump gasoline and electric charging. That's not the ratio for those, right?
No, definitely not. And so this is kind of part of the conversation around these is, you know, do we have the infrastructure to support this number of electric vehicles? And it has been improving a whole lot around the country. But the fact, you know, all the studies are showing that the owners, electric vehicle owners, are not really relying on this infrastructure because they're doing all their charging at night in their garage or at their house. You know, they just plug in and charge it overnight. The public charging stations are really kind of a secondary, only use them if you have to.
When it comes to EVs, somebody texted in, if you have a Tesla, you're fine. Is there a big difference between Tesla or the other EVs that are out there, or fully EVs, be whatever manufacturer they are?
Well, Tesla is certainly the most popular EV currently. But the other manufacturers, GM and Ford, I mean, they're making huge gains, and they have a lot of different models now. So I would say that, you know, they are catching up very, very quickly. You know, but the funny thing is you can't buy a Tesla in Louisiana because we have a law that prohibits direct-to-consumer sales of vehicles.
You have to go through a dealership, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
You have to go through a dealership. So you cannot purchase a Tesla. You cannot purchase a Rivian.
Well, you're seeing a lot of them on the roads. And that thing I mentioned at the Exxon station on the highway to Manny, I think it's Highway 1, whatever the hell it is. I think that was a Tesla station. So when they have the Tesla charging stations, those are for Teslas only? You have some kind of code, or it only the connector only fits? Or how does that work? Do you know?
No, so most of the manufacturers have followed the lead of Tesla in the plug-in receptacles. Mm-hmm. They tend to fit. They're kind of universal now. So,
but somebody's
got to charge.
Let me take a break because somebody's got to pay for that power that you're getting from these charging stations. I guess I don't know if there's a. You put a credit card down? I don't know how that works. We'll continue to talk about it. We come back 8:51, 9 till 9. Tommy Tucker talking to Wesley Muller, staff writer at Louisiana Illuminator. I'll also ask you on the WWL Okunart Jeweler Talk and Text Line 504-260-1870. If you have an electric vehicle, what is it that made you want to get one? Or if you would not buy one, what is it that prevents you from buying one? 8:52, traffic now, WWL. 8:57, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about EVs and the infrastructure that's available or not in Louisiana with Wesley Muller, a staff writer at Louisiana Illuminator. I got a couple of texts here coming in, Wesley. I don't know if you can help us or not, but it says, has there been any movement by the legislature to make Teslas or vehicles directly available to the public and not having to go through a dealership?
The answer is no. In fact, the opposite has happened. Just this year, the legislature passed a law that kind of shored up the current state of the game. They passed this so-called freedom of choice for purchasing vehicles. It did not apply to the electric direct-to-consumer vehicles. So it was mainly to protect gas and diesel cars. So, you know, that's our state is lagging behind, you know, while the rest of the country, you know, is seeing one out of five cars, hybrid or electric. We are much, much lower in Louisiana, under 2%, I would say, which puts us 49th in the country. So it's
49th in the country when it comes to sales or infrastructure?
Sales, yeah.
Okay.
Sales.
So in Louisiana proper, the concern would not be as much for charging as it would for people traveling through the state. Am I getting this right or not?
So, yeah, that's correct. We are building chargers, but they don't really need to, because we don't really have the great number of EVs that are around the country. Now, that's going to change. You know, even though we have this law that prevents direct-to-consumer sales, you know, they're not going to be able to keep it up, I don't think, because, you know, it's just going to become more and more popular to purchase these. And, you know, people are already kind of asking them to change it, you know, so we'll see.
I wonder where tourism fits in all of this. We'll have to ask Billy Nungesser that, because, you know, if you want people to drive in from the area, if EVs are becoming increasingly popular, you would think you'd have to have charging stations, right?
Yeah, you know, but, you know, as I said earlier, most people are charging at home. Mm-hmm. They're not really using the public charging station.
But if they're driving from Florida, they wouldn't be able to do that, would they? No.
Right, right. They would have to stop and charge up.
Gotcha. Thank you, Wesley. Appreciate the time. Wesley Muller, staff writer, Louisiana Illuminator. We'll talk to DA Jason Williams about ankle monitors and juvenile justice when we come back.
This is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune. I'm CNBC senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.
All right, 9:08 on this beautiful Wednesday morning, joined by District Attorney Jason Williams. How you doing, Jason?
Good, Tommy. How are you this morning?
I'm all right. You got to love this weather, huh?
Any little bit we get, we got to appreciate it.
Amen.
It's a big blessing.
Let's talk about juvenile ankle monitoring and what happened. This is the second juvenile involved with a homicide, as I understand it, in 2024 that was on ankle monitoring or an untracked ankle monitor. Take us through this if you can, and then we'll talk about it.
I don't want to get into the details of the current investigation of the young man's homicide. Obviously, that wouldn't be prudent.
Yeah.
There are still some juvenile protections in terms of why and how he was on a monitor. It is public knowledge, and his grandparents have described him having gotten involved in the juvenile criminal justice system, causing the courts to, I believe the hearing officer in this particular situation, to order him to be placed on an electronic monitor. As has been reported, there were certain conditions that he was supposed to maintain while on an electronic monitor. His grandmother described his grades as improving, as him having a positive outlook on life moving forward. Realized he had made some bad decisions, but it seems he was somewhere he was not supposed to be, not his home, not school, with an electronic monitor on, and he was murdered. Now, there are no guarantees, Tommy, you know that. There are no ways to prevent all sorts of violence and malice in people's hearts, But if there was real-time monitoring here with this particular device, when he was not in the place that he was supposed to be, there would have been an alert. And if there were individuals responsible for responding to those alerts, he would have been picked up and detained, and the judge would have had questions for him about why he was on Bundy Road, where he was murdered. And without real-time monitoring, that simply is not happening. And there seems to be some groups that believe that it is unfair or harmful to kids to have requirements, to have restrictions, to impose discipline. And I think the opposite. I think it is harmful to kids not to have discipline, not to have rules, not to have guardrails. And when you have a young man who is placed on a monitor, the system has said, courts have said, we believe we should know where you are. We should monitor you more than other individuals. And without real-time monitoring, it's a fallacy.
So there's a new law that goes into effect on January 1st. Is that it?
That is correct. That is correct.
That requires, tell me about the new law.
So the new law, and I take my hat off to Matt and Jill Dennis for their work at the State House with the senators and representatives that worked on it. It basically raises the standards for companies that are making money by doing electronic monitoring. It requires that there be actual monitoring and actual reporting. And when they don't do their job, they can be held, these companies can be held criminally responsible. That is a huge, major, important first step statewide. It's needed across the entire state of Louisiana. We remember what happened with that poor woman in West Feliciana, where her abusive husband was gaming and playing with his monitor to get closer and closer to her house until he could eventually kill her. However, there's other steps that need to be taken, especially as it relates to juveniles and young people, and that is real-time live monitoring, where someone is doing that same thing that family members do with each other with iPhones. They look at the dot to see where they are in the city, whether they're close to home around dinner time, and they make a call if they're not. We need that same activity happening in the criminal legal system, especially as it relates to juveniles, and we need immediate, quick intervention, meaning picking that person up when they're outside the geographic locations that they could be in, whether it's home, school, and work, or if it's a stay-away order, keeping them away from a person that they potentially have victimized, and the court has said they're giving them a second or third chance. As soon as they get close to the person they're supposed to be, that doesn't exist in the terms of the new law that will go into place in January. So I still believe the city of New Orleans, because that's where I live, that's where I work, needs to do more. And we need to have more restrictions and requirements on the courts, the hearing officers, the penal systems that use these electronic monitors to make sure that they go the next step and make sure that there's real-time monitoring. The technology is good, but the use of it by human beings involved in the system still is not up to where it needs to be to prevent loss of life.
Wait, say that part again, Jason, because I'm confused, because I thought the state law would ensure that it had to be like the stuff that Matt Dennis was doing, no?
It ensures it in terms of the technical proficiency of the equipment, right? But we have to make sure that if a judge has ordered a monitor, we have to make sure if a hearing officer has ordered a monitor, that there are terms and conditions that have been explained to this defendant that if he goes anywhere other than school and work, that's a violation. He's going to be picked up. If it's cut off, he's going to be picked off. And it needs to happen immediately. And there are a couple of other steps that I believe still leave room for error in the juvenile system as it's set up right now. There's no requirement that the monitors that are used in the juvenile system have real-time monitoring. And if you don't have that, as you know from being one, young people, they don't test limits. They're more impulsive, and they need to know that someone will notice quickly and respond promptly when they deviate from what is expected of them. And that still requires that judges, court hearing officers, and penal institutions, when they say, we're putting you on this monitor and we're letting you out, we are also requiring these other steps happen, and there will be swift consequences when it doesn't happen.
So the law, again, Jason, I'm confused. I'm not trying to be dumb here, but when it comes to January 1st, the law still has loopholes in it?
You know, Tommy, I don't think it's a loophole as much as it is making sure that there is an agency or individuals that are going to be responsible for that swift pickup when there's a violation. If you remember, over 10 years ago, the NOPD was responsible for pickup when there's a violation. That lasted for a while. Then the sheriff was responsible when there was a violation. That lasted a while. If you remember more recently when the individual escaped and none of us were told that he had escaped, they did not notify the public of the escape. There was no requirement that the individual be picked up. He had violated the terms and conditions of that monitor long before there was any notice. So the new state law still leaves all the discretion that existed before with regards to courts. And if I'm not trying to, this is not about taking any discretion away from courts. This is about using technology and equipment wisely in the way that it was intended to be used. And and when we say electronic monitor, that's not a monolithic sort of term for all the ankle bracelets that are out there. There are some that are not where there is no real-time monitoring. And right now, there's no requirement that the bracelet or the technology that's used in Orleans Parish is equipped with real-time monitoring, nor is there a requirement that there is someone who will immediately leap into action and go make that pickup when there is a violation. Now, TSAP does this, but they do that with the people they are monitoring, and there are a number of other companies that do this work.
So after January 1st, nothing's going to change? It's still at the discretion of the court?
Nope. A lot's going to change on January 1st.
Well, that's what I'm confused about, Jason. I don't understand what we're talking about here.
Okay, so the legislation that will go into effect in January is more specifically tailored to addressing the companies that provide electronic monitoring in the state. What are their obligations? What are their responsibilities?
Gotcha.
They do not address what will our courts do? What are our judges required to do if they're using this particular technology? Are they required to use real-time monitoring bracelets over other forms of bracelets? They have some that are wristwatches that are bigger than the things on people's ankles, and there's no requirement there that there is someone that is looking at a screen to make sure that this person is where they're supposed to be, or checking for alerts to find out when that person is out from where they are. So this new law does not address how these things will be used uniformly in all courts throughout Orleans Parish and all the other parishes of the state. I hope that kind of clears it up. I'm happy to.
We'll pick it up when we come back, Jason, because, you know, I've been to Matt Dennis's office and seen the way they do it and understand that when somebody violates, he lets the judge know, right? Isn't that the way it works?
That's right. That's absolutely right. He very quickly lets the judges know, and that's a huge piece. And if you recall before, there was the issue with the juvenile or the chief saying, well, we've got 4,000 warrants that have come through, 4,000 warrants that are outstanding. So how do we raise or an alert pickup for these 40 alerts for young people who might be running out in the French Quarter at night, right, to make these different and a higher priority than some other low-level, maybe perhaps technical violations that have nothing to do with an electronic monitor.
Let me take a break, quick, pick it up. We come back talking to DA Jason Williams. You got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. Maybe we'll take it through an imaginary case study and see what happens now, what would happen on January 1st, and how it can be fixed. Tommy Tucker, back in a flash, WWL. It is 9:25. Rejoining Jason Williams, District Attorney, talking about ankle monitoring in juveniles. And I think you're dead on accurate when you say, Jason, that it's especially important for juveniles, given that juveniles are naturally more impulsive and willing to test boundaries. Rafael Goyeneche saying that these monitors need to be monitored on a real-time basis. Prime example of a technology that works that's not properly being utilized on the juvenile side, but he goes on to say that it's not the judge's fault. So let me do this. Maybe, Jason, it might help everybody understand it better. Say Tommy Jr., okay, my son is hanging with the wrong crowd, and he's 15, and he gets in trouble, and I want to make sure that he's safe. I'm doing my best job as a parent, but he gets in trouble with court, so he gets put on ankle monitoring by a judge. Before January 1st, maybe now and then, however you want to phrase it to make it most understandable, what happens from that point once he gets an ankle monitor? Now, I realize if it's with, and I'll ask this long question and you can answer, if it's with Matt Dennis's company, then there's going to be real-time monitoring, and if he cuts the ankle monitor off or goes outside of where he's supposed to be, then the judge is going to get a notice. But even if that happens as it stands now, whose responsibility is it to go get him and go pick him up?
No one.
Okay. Well, that's peeing up a rope.
Exactly. I mean, it is a huge step towards having real accountability, but it is an incomplete loop. The new law come January 1st has very strict rules for Matt and Jill Dennis and any of the other companies that are selling or administering this technology. Very important. They have to send an alert within 24 hours to law enforcement, to courts, right? That's important. Before, that wasn't even happening. But it does not impose any stricter rules on the judges or hearing officers or penal institutions that are saying, young man, Tommy Jr., mm-hmm. I want you on an ankle monitor because I believe we need more eyes on you, right? So now, let's say January 2nd, Tommy Jr. is in the French Quarter at 2 a.m. in the morning. There is an alert that he is away from his home. And Matt Dennis reports that information immediately to a juvenile court. The juvenile court can say, we want him to come in so we can talk about why he was in the French Quarter at 2 a.m. in the morning, and we're going to set it for next week or 3 weeks out.
Say that to whom, Jason?
They could order. They could have a warrant issued for his arrest and have him brought into court. Or they could say to his lawyer, "We want him brought in to have a hearing about why he was out." Or they could ignore it and they could do nothing. And they could just address it when he comes back for his regular scheduled court appearance and say, hey, I've got three violations. It seems you were in the French Quarter two nights over the past three weekends. What's going on with that? And just have a conversation about it. What I'm saying is I believe we need to have uniform protocols for violations on electronic monitor that say if you're out past that curfew or you cut it off, then you should be detained the moment that alert comes through, 30 minutes past the violation, an hour past the violation. Now, if the judge chooses to give you a second chance after you were brought in, after there was a hearing and there's an explanation about what occurred in your home, maybe there was some abuse in a home and you were fleeing from that abuse, and the judge says, okay, that's understandable. That's an exceptional situation. You're being released back out into this, but let's look into this abuse situation. As of right now, it is a hodgepodge of what the response will be for this young person, if there will even be a response to that violation. And I think we need stricter rules on that, especially as it relates to young people, because they don't know what to expect. And as soon as they realize they can get away with something once or twice, they continue to do it.
So calling the lawyer or having the person come in a couple of weeks from then or a couple of days later, whatever, reviewing that, that wouldn't have kept this young man from being shot. It wouldn't have kept the tour guide from being shot by that 15-year-old. Is there any way, and I know the technology exists, and I know Matt Dennis and Jill Dennis, and I honestly don't think that they're trying to build business for themselves. I think they got enough business that they get more business they can handle now. I think they're trying to fix a system that they see is severely broken. And I know Matt, and he doesn't want kids in jail. He's the first one to tell you, no, you gotta, if you put the kid in jail, there's no future. They got to be able to go to school and continue with their life and everything else. That's why the importance of ankle monitoring and monitoring it properly be done by everybody. But as you're saying, if the loop is open, then the whole thing goes to hell. So at what point does the bonding agent, somebody like Matt or Jill Dennis or another company that does this, at what point would they be responsible? Because they are bail bondsmen, right? And they go out and get people at jump bail. Would they be responsible for? Take me through that, Jason. How do you close the loop, I guess, is what I'm asking you.
So as it relates to bail companies, the market really dictates that they are more hands-on and more responsible than courts are with regards to
right.
Yeah. And to the dentist's credit, they are making their job harder, and it's a good thing because they realize it makes the public safer and it can make young people safer as well. It's more work, it's more steps. Now I believe that the big closing that loop would be for us to legislatively empower bail bond companies to go make that pickup for the system, for the courts, right? So if there's a violation, we don't need any extra steps. You should be immediately picked up by if it's a bonding institution like ASAP, they go pick that person up, and that person has to wait until they are seen by a judge to have a discussion and an understanding about why there was a violation. It may mean that young person or that defendant, because this applies to adults as well, but right now we're talking about juveniles, it may require that person no longer can be an electronic monitor. This person perhaps needs to be detained. I would dare say to you that if a person can't stay away from a dangerous environment and they've been told they can't be in this dangerous environment and the electronic monitor shows that they are there, I believe anyone that loves them, grandparents, parents, friends, would rather them spend 7 to 10 days in jail or a year in jail, but be alive, right, to make better decisions in the future. Because this is not just about protecting the public. This is about protecting the public and the young person from being a victim of violence themselves, which is what happened in this case. So I don't think it's draconian to say that if you're not where you're supposed to be when you're on a monitor, that you are immediately yanked back into the system to figure out why you weren't, to figure out if you deserve this. Because think about it, an ankle monitor is a second opportunity. Mm-hmm. This is not a right. It's not in the Constitution that you get to have an ankle monitor. So if you get the benefit, the luxury of your freedom, although it is curtailed somewhat, if you violate that, then there should be immediate, swift, and certain consequences. And I don't think it's unfair. I think it is absolutely fair and good for young people.
Going back to the example of Tommy Jr., right? Who would be against this? Because if it worked ideally with what the dentists have going on now at ASAP, the alert would go out. If, as you're saying, they would be empowered, they'd send somebody out, pick up the kid, take him to the Juvenile Justice Intervention Center, correct? Juvenile Justice Intervention Center.
Juvenile Justice.
Where I sat with some kids there with Freddie King councilmen, and they said to a person they were happier to be there than out on the street because they felt safer. So I guess with that being said, Jason, who would be against this? Because it makes every bit of sense. I'm missing something or what?
Tommy, that's the part I don't understand. I don't see who can who would want to obstruct this, who would want to be in the way of this. I think the discipline, proper use of electronic monitoring technology with real-time tracking can not only interrupt juvenile criminal activity, but it can play a really vital role in protecting the young people as well as the public at large. So I don't see why anyone would fight this. This seems to be common sense. When I talk to people in the public, they assumed this would be part and parcel to the use of any electronic monitor once real-time capabilities became available. I mean, if my wife is going to use this to figure out if I'm still working in the DA's office or if I'm on my way home because I said I'll be home at 6 and she's trying to figure out when to put the rice on, you know, if she can pick up an iPhone and figure out where I am between South White Street and Uptown, then we certainly can do it for our most vulnerable population, and we should be doing it.
So as it stands now, even if somebody's out on ankle monitoring, if it's not monitored, let me go with the not monitored first, and they cut the ankle bracelet off, there's no consequences, nothing happens? I mean, what happens from that point? This sounds crazy to say,
It is crazy to say it. There are no immediate consequences to cutting that monitor off unless you are in the dentist's system because you have signed paperwork saying that you will respect and honor the terms and conditions of this ankle monitor, and cutting it off is a violation of that one. And they have very strict rules about immediately going and getting the person that is under their control.
They have the ability to go pick up the person. That's in their purview because of the agreement that the person signs?
Because that person has signed a contract with them when they bonded out and got that electronic monitor.
So they can do that.
They can do that with that select group of individuals.
Because of the civil contract that takes place between the bondsman and the person that's being bonded and wearing the monitor, their parents, not the state law. Accurate?
That is exactly correct, though.
Okay, I got you.
That is exactly. And I believe we can adopt something very similar that would empower companies that have the bandwidth, have the manpower to make those swift pickups. And require that be done with some sort of civil document that the defendants have signed and agreed to when they gain their freedom after being charged with a crime.
All right, so your lawyer, would that have to be done through legislative statute? Would that have to be done through city ordinance, city charter change? Take me through that part, Jason.
I think it could be an ordinance from the city council. I think it could be legislative action from the state capitol. I know this is needed around the state. I talked to a lot of other DAs, a lot of other heads of police departments and sheriff's offices who wish that it was in place. But frankly, I think we have made such big strides in the last 2 years as it relates to crime, carjacking, juvenile crime. I think we got to keep our foot on the gas, and this is one of those areas where there's a very big gap that we can close very easily with funds that are available right now, with smart, common sense legislation that I believe will make our young people safer and make the public safer. I mean, and think about what the grandparents said about this young man. They wanted more consequences as he was working his way through the system, because those consequences seem to help him get on the right track. That's what most adults want for the young people they love.
I know you have to go, but I would just have to ask, when you're in Baton Rouge on September 5th, anybody ask you about any of this?
They did not.
I didn't think so.
They did not.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate your time. Jason Williams, New Orleans District Attorney, 938-22 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:45, quarter till 10. Beautiful day for a bike ride, to get out on a bicycle, ride around, but be safe. Aline Laspina joins us now. Did I say that right, Aline? Where is it?
Perfectly.
Laspina?
Thank you so much.
Laspina. Aline Laspina, Executive Director of Bike Easy. How are you?
Pretty good. I couldn't believe how cold it was this morning.
Cold?
I was like, what a change.
Girl, what are you talking about?
Cold.
I mean,
it's so chilly compared.
Well, compared, yeah.
I
prefer to be about 32 below, but that's just me, which might be a little bit colder on your bicycle. You know, I used to
Hopefully
hate to ride can. About riding a bike is against the wind. It was always so much
that's
easier.
That's the worst.
It is the worst. Thank you. Tell me about the Bike Easy bicycle second line that's coming up.
So this Saturday, we're celebrating big for our bike community. We are having our biggest event of the year, which is called the Bicycle Second Line. Basically, we have a brass band, in this case, Tremet brass band, in a trailer, and then hundreds of bikes riding behind it. It's we meet up at the broadside at 10 a.m. We roll out at 11, and then we also have police escort. So, you know, it's welcome for anybody who's maybe a little not as comfortable riding a bike. You know, they're going to be blocking the traffic for us to be safe. We usually have 200, 300 people ride with us, which is really great, multi-generation. We have people with kids, people with trailers and dogs. I mean, there's a little bit of everyone. And then when we get back to the broadside, we'll have a big after party with Suit Magnolia and Soul Rebels, which is the first time we do a big, big after party. And all of this is free, so really excited to just celebrate the bike community on Saturday.
So how do people find out more about this?
You can go to bikeeasy.org. You'll get a pop-up window that pops right away with all the information that you need.
And it's all free?
It's all free. I just ask people to let me know they're coming so I have enough snacks offer you in the morning.
You got to have enough snacks. What kind of snacks you going to have?
Well, in the morning, we'll have some water. We'll have granola bars, some fruits. And then there'll be food vendors during the after party. And obviously, you have access to the bar and the concession stands. That you do have to pay your own drinks. We are offering the entertainment.
Well, it's not, you're not giving a wedding reception here, Alina, anything. It's not completely free. Hey, let's talk about, seriously, biking in New Orleans and bike safety. And I'm going to tell you my story, and I'm not trying to pit anybody against anybody. I'm just going to tell you about human nature, okay? I'm going to a magazine, going home, and I tried to avoid a pothole, and I kind of weaved into the bike lane, and it was a nice day. The windows were down. And a guy on a bike said, you know, you're really not supposed to weave into a bike lane. I said, okay. But when I got to the red light at Magazine and Calliope, he ran right through the red light. And I couldn't help myself but scream, you know, you're not supposed to run through a red light, which I probably didn't have to do. But the point remains that both drivers and bicyclists need to be aware of each other and adhere to the rules of the road. Thoughts?
Absolutely. Well, I completely agree.
Well, tell us a little bit more about what people should be, what both bicyclists and drivers need to be aware of as it relates to the other. Because, look, we're all just trying to get there alive, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, it goes down to the basic. Share the road. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all at the end of the day, whether we're, as we would say, a cyclist, biker, or a driver, or a pedestrian, we're people using the road. And you know, we teach classes to drivers at the end of the day. Whether you consider yourself a driver, you're also a person walking to your vehicle, even if it's just to your driveway. You're the most vulnerable road user. So be aware that you're sharing the road with other people. I think it's, when we teach to people who bike, it's like we have the same rights as people who are driving in the road, but we also have the same responsibilities. Like, we try to harp that down, because, you know, how are you going to be predictable if you're, running lights or riding where you're not supposed to be riding against traffic? People should not be doing that either. You know, it makes it hard, very dangerous. If you have a collision, it doubles the impact of the speed, and people don't realize that because they think, well, if I'm riding against traffic, they'll see me. But no, what will happen is that if they hit you, they're going to hit you even harder than if you're riding with traffic. So, you know, being predictable, signaling, you know, that goes for both people driving and people biking, you know, making sure you signal. I think eye contact is huge when, you know, I ride my bike almost every single day. I'm a big bike commuter. And, you know, when you're crossing intersections like Lefty Greenway and Broad or Claiborne, like, eye contact goes a long way with the driver. So they know what you're planning on doing. I think it's, share the road.
Do you think sometimes it becomes adversarial when it doesn't have to be?
Correct. No, yeah. I mean, I think people get frustrated when they're on the road and they just take it out on people, you know? I mean, I think there's bad apples everywhere, you know, in terms of behavior. I think we're trying to make sure we address that, not just with education, but also making our infrastructure a little bit better, so people understand, like, okay, bike lane, this is where bikes go. Car lane, this is where car goes. But you have things like Jackson, where it's a share the road with vehicles. But
I think people need to realize that, first of all, some of the best advice my parents ever gave me is that the right of way is not something you have. It's something people give you. If they don't give it, you don't have it. So you got to be aware of that. You have to be defensive when you drive. You have to realize that each incident is independent and distinct from each other. Just because one guy is a bad driver or the other's a bad bicyclist, that doesn't mean everybody's a bad driver and against you, or everybody's a bad bicyclist and against you.
Correct.
And let me ask you this, sincerely, Aline, when it comes to this bike lane situation, being in the far right lane, if I'm going down, say, Camp Street, Camp Street heads from Calliope to Canal, right? I got that right? I take it every morning, but I don't know if I got the right street or not. No. It's Drew Camp. Yeah, that's right, Camp Street. So if I'm heading down Camp and I'm at Poydras and the light is green, it's also green for the bicyclist who is in the right lane, which means I would have to turn in front of them. Who's got the right-of-way in that situation?
Actually, the right-of-way right there would be the bike because they're going straight. As if, it's exactly as if it was a vehicle.
Okay. So yes. It is in a somewhat bad design because they have traffic turning across traffic that's going straight, right?
Yeah, there could be better signaling for sure. I mean, I think there's a couple places in the city they have this thing called a bike box. You'll see that when, you know, Tulane Avenue is a little bit different because they have the bike lane on the left.
Right.
And right before the interstate, there's a transition, or they call it the bike box, so the person can actually get in front of the traffic so they know I'm going to be going straight because people are about to enter I-10 right there. So, you know, there's definitely improvements that could happen. And, you know, Poydras is having improvements coming up. So you'll see some changes.
Well, I come to work early in the morning, and I'm always extremely careful about making a right turn on a green light to make sure there's nobody in a bicycle lane. Give me some final thoughts on sharing the road.
Just at the end of the day, remember, we're all people in the road, most vulnerable road users. Share the road, be aware of your surroundings, and be predictable.
And
that would be my best advice.
And one final word about the bicycle second line?
Come on out and say hello. Learn a little bit more about our organization. We've been around for 21 years.
All right. What,
bring me your concerns and your ideas.
Tell me about the organization if somebody wants to join. What do you guys do?
We're considered an advocacy group, but we do also community work, education. And when it comes to advocacy, yeah, it's going to City Hall, doing canvassing, you know, advocating for more bike lanes, etc. But also for education, we do driving classes. For example, for the RTA, we did a campaign with them to teach their drivers how to share the road with people walking and biking. We teach people of all ages and abilities, and when community events like this one, and also we do free bike valet at some of our events. We just did Blues Bike Barbecue Festival last weekend. So encouraging folks to bike in their community. So, yeah, we've been around 21 years, and I'm sure we'll be around 21 more.
Well, let's hope everybody drives safely. Scale of 1 to 10, 1 being not at all, 10 being extremely. How bike-friendly is New Orleans, would you say?
I'm going to say we're probably an 8.
Really?
We're pushing on an 8.
That's
awesome. Yeah, we've increased the number of bike lanes in the last 10 years alone a lot, and the city is about to have a lot of money coming in from EPA grants in the next 3 years that is going to increase the number of bike lanes in the city, and hopefully that means that we learn to cohabitate with each other better. You know, there's definitely a shift in the needle in terms of being more welcoming to people on bikes, I believe. You know.
We need to cooperate with everybody in every way. Thank you, Aileen. I appreciate your time. Happy
Thank
biking.
Thank you, Tommy. Have a beautiful week.
You too. Okay. Aileen Laspina, Executive Director of Bike Easy. A quick break, then we'll find out what Newell's got for us when we come back on WWL.
This is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune. I'm CNBC senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.